Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. Margaret Placentra Johnston has spent most of her life helping people see better, literally. A practicing optometrist, she examined eyes one pair at a time in Springfield, Virginia for 25 years before detecting the need to offer clearer vision of a different kind on a larger scale. In her new book, Faith Beyond Belief, Stories of Good People Who Left Their Church Behind, Margaret shares how a bird's eye view of the religious belief versus non-belief debate from a spiritual development perspective can lead to a kinder, more gentle world. And she is here with us today. Margaret, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kara. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, now, first of all, what inspired you to write this book? What brought on this additional career after your first or perhaps second successful one as an optometrist?
Right, thank you. It started around 2004. I had just sold my practice, and my children had gone off to college, and my responsibility level went from a breakneck level to very easy, just seeing patients a few days a week. And I had time on my hands, and I happened to notice that around election time in 2004, there were certain segments of society that were really making a really big deal about their literal religious beliefs and using it as almost a political weapon. And I thought, you know, I had read just enough about spiritual development in the past that I thought, well, where they're coming from, this is not the most mature way to approach religion or belief or whatever. And I thought someone should really explain. Yes, books had been written about the spiritual stages before, but I thought someone should bring it down to a more common level where the average person would readily appreciate or understand. And I started to think someone should really write a book with stories that illustrate the process. And unfortunately, after a period of time, I realized that sort of, if not me, then who? You know, suddenly I have time, I have energy, I have the knowledge, I have the writing skills, apparently, and I thought, well, okay, I guess it's me then.
Thank you. Now, so you detected a need out there, specifically around the idea of development, because you observed that in some communities, beliefs remain the same, perceptions remain the same, and you started to question about growth, and, you know, I can understand that. How does our journey evolve in life? Do our ideas evolve? How do they evolve? And our relationship with God, even our perception of God, how do these things develop? And so you wrote this book in an answer to that. Now, could you share just a little of your own journey? Were you raised in a religious or spiritual household?
Well, yes and no. I was raised Catholic, but there was always a feeling that there wasn't that much feeling to the religion. It was more like if you do what you're supposed to do, you will go to heaven. If you don't break the rules, if you don't have a mortal sin on your soul, you'll go to heaven. But it was a rather mechanical sort of understanding that I was given, or that I, from what I understood, that's the way I understood it, in a mechanical way. And I went to, all through Catholic school, all the way from first grade, all the way to, actually, master's degree from the Catholic University of America. And but the high school religion classes, they started. There was one priest in particular who very clearly came out and said, all these things you studied in elementary school, all these Bible stories, they were allegorical. And heaven and hell, not such a place. You know, they're just states of being. There's no geographical heaven.
Really?
And hell. And furthermore, you know, Jesus was not literally the Son of God. That was anthropomorphic language. So this is all intriguing to me as a high schooler, I thought, this is so cool that they're sharing this information. And surely next year they will tell us what the truth really is. And to my disappointment, the following years were, you know, courses in comparative religion. Interesting as that might be, that did not answer my questions. And family life, I didn't answer questions. So that by the time I was looking for a college, I thought, I really, really don't know what to believe, and I need to study this at a higher level. Mm. So I chose the Catholic University of America, which was a funny incident. The high school guidance counselor called me in and he said, I have to speak to your parents about your choice of college. So my parents marched in there, and the guidance counselor announced, your daughter is choosing a radical institution. And I'm sure this was, you know, the late 60s, and I'm sure my parents assumed that he meant politically radical, and they didn't think I was at risk for any politically radical behavior, so, you know, it sounded good to let me go. And it must have been 20 or 30 years later I realized he meant theologically radical.
Right.
Because we got there, and they just got us to question everything. And we were told, you will flunk this course if you give us catechism answers. You are to give us original thought, critical original thought. So, you know, what do you think happened?
Yeah.
I just reasoned myself out of all belief, you know, because that's almost what we were encouraged to do. Mm. Or so I felt at the time.
Well, somewhere in there, this is very important information, by the way. I want to thank you for your candor. You know, but somewhere between the mechanical rules and the it's all an allegory is probably some truth in between, where the kind of spiritual rubber meets the road, as it were. But nonetheless, having one person inspire your imagination like that and to free you up, you know, is a great invitation. To a young person, especially at that age. And now your book, now you've got to tell me, though, all these years later, after all these years as an optometrist, how did it come up to be a priority? I mean, were you discussing this, you know, during sessions with folks? Or were you, I mean, how did the priority of this come to the forefront of your life?
Well, to carry what happened to me a little farther, 20 years out of college, I came across M. Scott Peck's books about his spiritual stages. And the first time I heard of this, what he called his level four, the mystic stage and whatever, I was blown away. I mean, I was just like, oh, is that what they were trying to lead us towards at Catholic U? It just suddenly dawned on me, oh, this could be important. And so I started studying just gradually. I mean, I was raising my children. I was running my practice. I was very busy. But as time permitted, I would study a little more. I read Fowler and, you know, a few other people.
Yeah.
And I started to realize these people all sort of agree. You know, maybe they don't use the same terminology. Maybe they have different numbers of stages. But they are sort of pointing things in the same trajectory.
Hmm.
And so if there's enough commonality among these people in what they said, then there must be some truth behind it. And if that's the case, why don't people know?
Mm.
You know, why do we have people going around, you know, spouting out the literal levels? And why do we have people turning away from religion altogether because they don't realize that there is a level at which a rational person can accept all this?
Yes, that's true, and there is the trend, of course, of rejecting the church, and thereby also rejecting whatever spiritual riches there may be in there anyway to be teased out, right. Sort of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So, and there is a trend taking place, and your book brought to mind other books, for example, Leaving Church, a memoir of faith by Barbara Brown Taylor, who was clergy. And another, Finding God Again, Spirituality for Adults, by another Catholic priest, John Shea, which suggests this struggle that is taking place and the increasing awareness about it. We find the phrase spiritual, not religious, emerging in our culture and is now also being approached critically. I don't mean critically as in being judged. I just mean examined. You know, in mainstream media and scholarship. What do you think about this trend? What does this phrase mean to you, spiritual, not religious? What does it mean in people's minds?
Well, I think it can take several connotations, and unfortunately the word spiritual has some connotations that are not favorable. I mean, people with, you know, using the term to say, like, spiritual development to mean developing the ability to see past lives and communicate with the dead, and, you know, rational people are not always pleased to affiliate with that type of thing, so there's a distancing that a certain type of person will do when they hear the word spiritual, they just want to reject. But for people who do accept the word spiritual, but not religious, there are also some who just have rejected the religion and haven't done anything else about it, and so I guess they're flying on feeling, so to speak, or, you know, whatever it is they're that's attracting them to the word spiritual. I like to think I'd take the word a little bit farther by saying that there's a specific trajectory that's been studied by various experts that, you know, if you're rejecting the religion to be really spiritual, you want to be moving towards this more, quote-unquote, mature level, where you have, you know, rejected the literal, but you're reaccepting something about spirituality and possibly even belief.
Yes, and that makes sense. That's good advice. After 100 programs on faith around the world, as we've done in the past couple of years here, to me, spirituality remains at the true core of faith. You know, what, even in the religious institutions, not necessarily competing with it. It tends to be in the more embodied by the mystical traditions of the church. You know, for example, in the Catholic Church, the communion of saints, and they tend to always focus, nonetheless, on some form of surrender to new growth, and that we can't get around this. That this is a nature of spirituality. It's not meant to merely comfort, but that we are to progress in it. So, if this is at, let's say, remains at the core, this progression of most world religions, then what would you say about religion is being abandoned, and why? Why are people rejecting it? And what's your experience?
Well, the way it appears to me is that as our world gets more sophisticated in that we have global communications coming in from all over the world, and with the internet, people are coming across people from all different beliefs and all different backgrounds and cultures, and they can't really accept the thought that only Christians are good people. I mean, it just is not possible to believe that if you've been honestly facing the world as it's presented to us now. So I think what's being left behind is people are perhaps reasoning themselves out of their literal beliefs, you know, that Jesus was literally the Son of God, whatever that means. And they're either moving away from belief altogether, or they're finding a more sophisticated, perhaps, way of reapproaching or engaging with religion / spirituality.
Mm. Now, let's just say, if Jesus is the literal Son of God, and you're another or daughter, and Muhammad really is the prophet, that can still remain within this new framework, wouldn't you think? We could still progress with each other as well, without abandoning a basic thought like that?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think you have to take the terminology very literally, I mean, very not literally, very loosely, to accept that one religion is just as true as another. And unfortunately, amongst the people who got me inspired to write the book, the people who were spouting this literalness and this triumphalism, basically, that they have found the only true faith, amongst those, I don't think they see it that way. You know, I think, so the point is that many, like what happened to me, I didn't hear this other level, okay? When I went to college, I just heard, okay, we're not going to believe this literal stuff, and I didn't hear any words, you know, maybe it's because I'm not particularly skilled at this, but I did not hear anything that drew me back towards faith for 20 more years, you know, so I just felt that was a shame, because so many people would not ever find a way to move back towards any type of spirituality once they reason themselves out of the literal level.
Well, I love your use of the word triumphalism, because I actually haven't heard that on the program yet. And it's a great term to describe the struggle that people have. And perhaps that's at the core of this, that there are many people in the West, you know, in America that we know of and around the world, that would like to move beyond the triumphalism, the one overall way of thinking, and realizing, you know, this is fragmenting us, it's hurting us, and we're hurting each other, even about things like books, you know, even books we haven't read, but feel very strongly about out there. So we're in a very interesting time, as you say, and technology is helping us to connect and communicate about these things. So to your view, then, what is faith beyond belief? What does it look like?
Well, while there seems to be a lot of commonality in, for example, in my book about the stories of people moving away from faith, the people who had found a faith that takes them beyond belief, there is tremendous diversity amongst what they wound up with. One became a Unitarian, one belongs to a Methodist church and teaches Sunday school there, but he does it in a sort of metaphorical way. There is one who became a Wiccan even. So, I mean, I think you can choose a way of expressing spirituality through any particular institution or possibly with no institution, and it's like none of them are wrong. You know, and I think that's kind of what faith beyond belief is, including that there's a trust in the universe or God or whatever you want to call it, and that you choose to try and connect to people and existence and God, if you want to use that word. And it's just based on trust. It's not based on literally, okay, I know if I go to Mass on Sunday, I'm not going to go to hell, I'll go to heaven. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, throughout the years that you've raised your children, you've been going through this struggle and now come out the other side with a wonderful book to give your kids. But how did it go along the way? What is the option in raising children then with this, you know, more open mindset?
Well, that's interesting. I had always assumed from the time I left college until I had children, which was a good 15 years, that I would raise them Catholic, and then when they were a certain age, I'm thinking 13, 14, I would say sort of what happened to me, but we don't believe all this literally. And yet, once my children were born, and like I took a first look at my first son, and I said, you know, I cannot lie, I can't tell him something I don't believe literally. And, you know, I didn't have any other way to explain it other than, you know, so we brought them up in the ethical humanist tradition.
Mm.
And that was very adequate. But now, as I've said, I put a comment in my book that this, in the introduction, that this book is the religious education that I never forced my children to get, you know, during their upbringing. They're old now; they're in their 20s.
Mm. And now, what is their view on spirituality? Because often, as what happened in my house, my father and mother were of different faiths, mm-hmm. and let me. As they said, they decided to, you know, not raise me with any, and for me to make my own decision when I grew up, and which I did, and it had a kind of a reverse psychology effect, where I was not raised with any religion, and then, you know, faith became my whole life,
right.
And learning about others' faiths around the world as well, and committing to trying to, you know, foster some peace in this because of the fighting. That goes on. So I'm curious where your children now in their 20s, what their worldview might be.
You know, you would really have to ask them. I mean, they're really good guys, and they're extremely ethical, and they're, you know, very upstanding members of, you know, society contributing. But as far as what they actually believe, I think you'd have to ask them. I don't think they take anything literally, but you know, whether they're even interested in spirituality, I don't think it's a big part of their life at this time. I think possibly as they get older, they'll reapproach it.
Now, I'm not sure if this has to do with your Catholic roots, but obviously this topic has been, you know, perking in your mind for a very, very long time, and you haven't actually left it, but are growing through this, which is fascinating to me. Why did this vision become important to you at this time of your life? Was it a reclaiming or a making sense of something that didn't in childhood? Why did this come around at this time with the kids grown up and such?
Well, I think it was merely just a question of me having time and energy to devote to something that, obviously, when I was so busy raising my children and running a practice and practicing seeing patients full time, I was, to say the least, extremely tied up with all that practicalities. But once the level of responsibilities diminished some, I had time and effort to think about things. And I did it out of a sense of responsibility. If you talk about why I wrote the book, I did it out of a sense of responsibility. I think I saw a viewpoint that I could share that would have, perhaps, it's not a book for everyone. Clearly there are people for whom the book is completely irrelevant. But I think there are enough people struggling with this type of issue that this might give them some perspective.
And that's an interesting point, too, you just mentioned. The book may not be for everyone. Were you hoping to have a broad audience for this, or do you think you might be preaching to the choir of like-minded folks? I mean, just, you know, seriously. I think everyone wants their thoughts, all of us as authors would like to be read widely by people who might even disagree with us to help affect those things. Do you feel you have the opportunity to do that?
I don't really want to appeal to a certain... So I did not write the book in hope of moving the literal believer beyond their level. I think there's a reason why they're there and a reason why they should stay there unless other life circumstances move them forward. But I thought there's enough people floundering around who have left belief, kind of, but they're not sure if they want to leave. You know, they were told that there would be evil if they... So there's people who are floundering with whether they should believe or not believe. I thought perhaps the perspective I was sharing would help them find their own way to their own truth, not so much that they have to take my truth.
Thank you very much for that. I liked the discussion of levels of spirituality, and we're going to discuss more of that in the second part of the program. We're about halfway through the show. Margaret, stay on the line. We're just going to take a short break. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation with Margaret Placentra Johnston, author of Faith Beyond Belief. Stay with us.
Now's the time for stepping out of place. Get up on your feet and give account of your faith. Pray to God or something, or whatever you do. What I see can make me stop and stare. But who am I to judge the color of your hair? Surely y'all are feeling much the same as I do. We got to keep this world together. Got to keep it moving straight. Love like we mean forever. So the people can relate. If you're rolling to your left, don't forget I'm on the right. Trust and forgive each other. A little love and we just might. Thinking of the troubles of today, is it easier to put that gun away? Or is it difficult to stop the world and show that you care? Everything and everyone we know is beautiful. Surely you will be the guiding light to save us all. Maybe we can be the vision of a prophet man's dream. This world together, gotta keep it moving straight. Love like we mean forever, so the people can relate. If you're rolling to your left, don't forget I'm on the right. Trust and forgive each other. A little love and we just.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're speaking with Margaret Placentra Johnston, author of Faith Beyond Belief, Stories of Good People Who Left Their Church Behind. Margaret, in this part of the program, I'd like to focus more on your book and what we were beginning in the previous part of the show regarding levels of spirituality. But first, I would just like to address that I notice you use the word good, in quotes there, good people in your subtitle about leaving church. Do you feel they need to be defended in our culture? Have they done something wrong in the eyes of the community?
They themselves have not, in a very general sense, not done anything wrong. What I was reacting to in the choice of that word is that some types of religion claim that without their way of belief, a person cannot have an ethical life. And without, you know, their Bible or their beliefs, you can't find your way to goodness, which clearly is not the case, and I wanted to bring that out, that the people who are making these choices in the book did so out of a higher and more deep respect for truth, literal truth in any case, than the people who never questioned or the people who just accepted everything they were taught in a literal sense. And that these people are good people, in a general sense. I'm sure we all do something wrong, but I'm talking about in a general sense.
Right.
Ethical and, you know, they have integrity.
Yes, and it sort of implies that there's a stigma associated with leaving the church. Mm-hmm. The title. I wonder how long you wrestled with the subtitle with the publisher. it's a very important point, of course, as everyone's on their own journey. Now, you approach your book, Faith Beyond Belief, through stages of spiritual development, and this is key. And you explore the stages through personal stories. Can you share with us and you can speak at length, you have the floor and we have time, about the stages of spiritual development as you have discerned them? What are they?
Okay, in my book and today right now, I'm going to choose not to present them in chronological order, and I'm not going to present them in the order in which they occur, because I think it's extremely counterintuitive, and the people who have written about these before, it doesn't seem to have ever filtered down to common knowledge for various reasons, but one of them might be that they are counterintuitive if you think of them in the way they occur. So I start with the rational group, which is actually the third in the structure in which I choose to use them. Some of these theorists have designated 12 stages. Some are only two. Some are four. So, but I, for simplicity, try to knock it down to four. Anyway, I start with the third stage, which is actually the rational stage. This is the people who are moving away from their literal beliefs. Usually it's something in their literal belief system clashes with something from the outside culture, and suddenly something doesn't make sense. And they have to wrestle with this. Do I believe the priest or the preacher or whoever he is, or do I reason things out for myself and trust my own inner reasoning process and make my own decision? So that's what we call the rational stage. It actually requires certain skills that actually are somewhat more mature than just believing literally. Because, for one thing, if everyone you know believes the same thing and you start to question it, you have to have enough sense of personal identity to say, okay, I am going to question it, and I'm going to trust my own being, my own reasoning powers.
Which might move you outside of the comfort zone of the...
Which moves you outside of the comfort zone of your family, your church, whatever it is. So that's one thing. And also you have to realize that something about personal authority is important, whereas some types of churches teach you that, you know nothing, you will follow our rules, you will read our Bible, you accept everything the preacher says because you don't have personal authority. So I was showing how these people develop their own personal authority, not that that's the ultimate goal, but that is an important step.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing, too, that you just mentioned. I know you're specifically referring right now to the, you know, the Christian faith and the Bible. But it's interesting in light of Scripture where Jesus says, all these things I do, you can do. Mm-hmm. And you're going to do even more great things. Mm-hmm. So when we consider that's not, if that's not the Scripture being shared and encouraged, mm-hmm. That may be one place where someone finds himself starting to question things. I think a lot of this might lie in interpretation as well, because any book can sort of be spun, you know, to promote any kind of response. But now, what might be an example, let's say, of this, of the rational stage? What kind of experience might someone go through where they say, hey, wait a minute, as you said, where something's not jiving?
Right,
like just
okay.
an example.
So one of the examples from the book, I'm going to use Kevin again. He is a Canadian veterinarian who is Catholic, and he got into a discussion with his parish priest about whether animals have a soul. And when the priest insisted that animals do not have a soul, Kevin began to mix this up with his knowledge of evolution, and he said, well, it seemed to me that either if humans are descended from animals, then either all animals have a soul and humans have a soul, or neither humans nor animals have a soul. It can't be just humans have a soul. And from that point, he started reasoning, and other things from his religion started to fall into question, and it eventually just reasoned himself out of the, reasoned himself away from the church altogether. Hmm. So that's one example.
That's a powerful one. Thank you. Now, in addition to the rational stage, what would be another stage in spiritual development?
So some of these people in the rational stage may, if they remain open to the information coming in and they have any interest, they may start to notice that you can't depend entirely on your own reason. There are bigger things than that. Sometimes it's one of the theorists, who's not so well known, K. Helmut Reich, he actually described five levels of reasoning skill, one of which is the lowest level is black and white, like either it's this or it's that. It has to be one of the two.
Yeah.
And then he outlines up to five more stages of increasing complex reasoning skills, at which the top, it moves towards saying, okay, both approaches are needed, so that might be, to explain the phenomena. So that might be equivalent in religion to saying, well, there's truth in Buddhism, and there's truth in Hinduism, and there's truth in Christianity, and we need all of this to make up a full picture. And then the person keeps reasoning themselves through, and they get to a point where they accept and appreciate the paradox of the fact that maybe we're not ever going to be able to have a full explanation. And at the top level, and again, I've never met anyone that I know of at this level, but the person can give an overarching synopsis for the entire, whatever topic is under discussion. So the point is that this rational level person at some point has to realize that things are not so black and white. It's not the either there is a God or not a God. There has to be many more factors involved, and it's much more complex, and we have to take in information from the scientists and information from the Holy Scriptures and, you know, all different religions, you know, around
yeah.
the world, and you have to need all of this to make up the full picture, and frankly, maybe we'll never get the full picture, and that might start moving them towards a more mystic, you know, I use the word
right.
mystic loosely, not in a literal sense, but it might move them towards this last, that we know of, this last stage.
Well,
it might not be the high stage.
It's almost as though the unknowing becomes acceptable and even perhaps enjoyable as mystery.
Precisely, and, yeah.
And we learn yeah. our, you kind of learn our place as we, you know, I truly enjoy learning about all the different faiths in the world and different, you know, pieces and practices and tenets and find the commonalities among them, you know, compassion being one. I start to tease out things, as you mention, a lot on the program. Here every week, and yes, understanding and accepting paradox is a great step, I think, after allowing for other points of view not only to exist but to enjoy them and learn about them, even celebrate them. So that's where this person winds up is with that broader view, but maybe not so many answers. Mm-hmm. So what might be another stage then in your book?
Well, before I get to that, I want to bring out, you brought up an important point, which is about the need for certainty versus the finding, the need for certainty is typical of the quote-unquote lower stages, and as they move up the stages, they come to appreciate mystery and even find it exciting, and the search is more important than the answer, so I just thought that was important to bring that out.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I've studied some of John Shea's work around that he calls it law and order spirituality, and it's that rules-based thing where God basically is either a punishing or rewarding parental figure. It's like a childhood perception of God. And it raises the question then, as we grow, does our image of God change to move beyond that punishing or rewarding parent?
Well, that was a perfect lead-in to, you asked me, what is another stage?
Oh, great.
And, so now we're circling back to this stage that presumably happens before the rational stage, and that is this law and order God, which is about, you know, punishment and following rules and, again, literal beliefs that this, you know, God is this father figure who's, you know, up there passing judgment on you. And the need to follow the specific literal rules. I mean, one example being, as a child, I was brought up Catholic, and we did not eat meat on Fridays. I mean, that was against, you know, there was like, it's horribly immoral to eat meat on Fridays. Well, now we can eat meat on Fridays, and Catholic or not. And the point is that was just a very superficial man-made rule that had nothing to do with being, as I know.
Yeah, it's not one of the essentials of faith.
It doesn't seem to be.
No.
So,
well,
again,
you know, this is the thing, Margaret. This is what people get stuck on, is, you know, what might be non-essential issues of faith that become, you know, huge problems between people in relationship.
Well, yes, and it also makes the individual religions look much different from each other than they need be, much more different than they need be. So people become triumphalist, and my religion is better than yours, and my God is bigger than your God, and that's not necessary if you can appreciate these traditions as such. They're just traditions, or a way of people expressing a universal call to connect with the divine, or whatever, you know, even just with other people or the universe. But the people at this law and order stage don't see that. They see it as a way to say my religion is better and everyone else should convert.
Right, or also within a congregation, to keep everyone believing exactly the same thing and doing exactly the same thing, otherwise there may be consequences.
Right.
So that's you know, something to deal with as well, depending on how conservative you know, your faith might be and where your comfort level lies in that.
Right. Exactly.
As you say, you know, law and order, it's a bit like policing.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, and a lot of folks will have a very serious reaction to what seems like policing the soul.
Mm-hmm.
If spirit is breath, how do I breathe? You know, how are we breathing here?
Right.
So please continue and share. And also, if you could let me know, let the listeners know, when you chose the folks to help illustrate the stages of development in your book and their personal stories, how did you choose them? What do they represent, therefore, to you?
It was an interesting process, which is going to sound a little strange when I say, but they just came marching into my life, all these people. and suddenly I mean, the rational ones were easy. Okay, those are rather clear-cut decisions these people made in a single step. The mystic stories, there are six of them. None of them is perfect, you know, and I hope people understand this in reading the book. I'm not putting these people up as examples of where we should be headed. By no means. They're just all human like you and I, and they have their flaws. But somehow there was something in each story that seemed to illustrate a characteristic that tends to happen at this quote-unquote mystic level. One example being someone who was brought up in an alcoholic family and she didn't realize this until she had gone through two alcoholic marriages as well. And she, only through Al-Anon did she get her life straightened out. But the point is, the way she explains, the way she describes the gratitude for the experiences in her life that brought her to the point where she is now, it's just really beautiful. And then even more, she didn't realize that her father had been an alcoholic until she went through these two alcoholic marriages and got involved with Al-Anon. Then she saw the light that her father, who had been a productive individual, not, you know, the typical that you think of as a drunk, she realized that he had, his influence had colored her whole life and all these difficulties she had had. And she described a dream where he came into her room and after he had died. And she yelled and yelled and told him all these, you know, about how, you know, his behavior had colored her entire life and brought all these difficulties. And she could have never said any of these things to her father when he was alive. He was not the type of person to whom you could speak. But she said after she did all that yelling and he just sat there and listened to her again in a dream, she felt tremendous sense of forgiveness toward him, and how, you know, she now she can appreciate how some of his traits actually have benefited her. She's very organized, and, you know, the way she carries out other aspects of her life are all due to his positive influence, and she can see that now. Instead of carrying a load of, I can't think of the word, the opposite of gratitude and the opposite of forgiveness. She can see clearer to forgiving.
And it's interesting, too, because Al-Anon, I believe, like the other 12-step programs, is rooted in also in a program that's spiritual at its core and goes through those same steps that involve... in a way, writing down your own part of things, you know, your own errors, the things you've done, and then, talking to someone else about it. It's almost like the confession model, in a way, and making amends, in there as well. Have you found, in your life that there's sort of a basic pattern of spiritual growth? I know you're going through the stages here now, but even therein, do you find that there is this, there's a pattern of taking responsibility, surrendering things, surrendering even an idea of self to move toward new growth?
Well, definitely, and I have to apologize for my lack of eloquence. Even if you read the book, I'm sure I did not explain it in anywhere near a full enough way, but I try to bring that out, how these people, not sort of the examples in my story, but you have to look beyond their humanness as well, but they all move towards a deeper sense of the meaning of the word gratitude and a deeper sense of the word forgiveness and a deeper sense of the word humility, compassion, community. All those words are appreciated in a deeper way, I think, at this upper level than they are at the literal, law and order level.
Well, that's great. Yes, and terribly important. Those to me are the words of, that's spirituality right there. Those great words you just said. And yes, I realize you're using the word mystic in a general way here, or as a higher level. But let's see, we've got the rational stage. We've got a mystic stage. Mm-hmm. We mentioned law and order,
which I call the faithful stage.
The what stage?
Faithful.
Faithful. Okay. And are there other stages?
Well, the one I don't like to talk about too much.
Ah, come on. I'll be gentle.
below the what I call the faithful stage. So backing up a minute. Apparently, people pass through these stages on their way from childhood, and so there are stages that are typical of childhood. And I haven't studied child development, so I'm not going to go into that very much. But in an adult, sometimes these childlike stages are arrested. In other words, they haven't developed past that. And then you have an adult who is less mature than the law and order stage. And in the book, I call that the lawless stage. And this is a person who is basically ego-driven and thinks really only of his own, fulfilling his own shall I say, superficial desires. I mean, they may not be good for him, but, you know,
right.
If he wants to go out and get drunk, then that seems like a good value and does it. Or if he wants to lie and cheat and steal in business, that seems like a good value and he'll do that too. And he's not restrained by the good parts of the law and order stage. You know, these people follow rules and they're mostly, speaking generally, they're mostly good people. But if it's the rules that are keeping them in line, and this person at this lawless stage, the rules don't. It's all superficial and manipulative. The person is manipulative. They may even go to church. They may even, you know, be even the preacher. But they may be at this lawless stage and doing it for reasons other than the overall good.
So can you give an example of that, of where someone in the congregation or even the minister might be lawless? And what, like, in what way?
Well,
I heard the getting drunk part, but...
Well, that's the thing. Some of these people are not, societally, they're not on the low scale. I mean, they may not be drunks or drug users. They might be very high in the society, and people don't realize that behind their motivations is all manipulation and self-serving
okay.
things. As far as an example, I'm not going to put up
right.
any person.
But a clergy person who's serving self or trying to be more than or... maybe abusing the situation, the circumstance, that the authority he or she has, or that kind of thing?
Well, it might be accepting money and then using it for, you know, buying nice cars instead of
right.
you know, giving it to the poor or whatever the purpose is.
Right.
It might also be manipulating people in their choices that have nothing to do with religion. It might be manipulating people in political areas, telling them how to vote.
Yes.
Sort of well.
Yes, I understand. Let's see. Now, what is there an end of the stages of spiritual development that you illustrate? Is there a result?
Well, as I understand, in my
or a goal, perhaps.
The goal is that there's higher. All what I described to you earlier, there's traits understood in a deeper way, the gratitude, the forgiveness, the humility. But also, I think where it leads to is a universal worldview, a sense of, you know, to use a trite phrase, but we all are one. That you don't see yourself as different from your neighbor who happens to be a Hindu or something. You see, you know, we're all part of the same entity. We're all one.
We're one big family.
One big family, and part of, you know, even nature and God and all that is all part of the same entity.
Thank you so much. That's lovely. So now, whether folks, like you say, the book is not for everyone, but it sounds like it's for a whole lot of people. What do you hope that they take away from this in terms of the stages awareness? Is there a way they can practice this or start to gauge where they are on this, you know, on the levels?
Well, one of the things that a point that's hard to make, and people, when I talk to them about the book, they often misinterpret my intentions. I'm not trying to give people an opportunity with which to judge someone else. You know, you don't want to say, oh, that person is such and such. And it's not even want to give them an opportunity to judge themselves so much or to try to move themselves forward, because we probably can't direct our moving forward.
Mm.
But what I was trying to do was perhaps give them to understand what influences they might want to respond to. If they know which way is forward in spiritual development, they can maybe perhaps resist those influences, which are very prevalent in our culture. It would hold them back. So the overly literal preacher, the divisive political scene. I mean, you just sort of want to move away from that divisiveness, turn it to fear, and, you know, make your own decisions.
Yeah. Oh, that's such an important point too. As we head into, of course, we're in the middle of an election campaign, and it's the last few weeks, so you know it's going to be brutal. And people do have extreme responses one way or the other that do divide us. I like to keep pointing out that George Washington, at his farewell address, warned us against the development of a two-party system.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, yes. And here we are. And, you know, the same kind of extremism, of course, happens in the arena of faith as well. So I really appreciate your work and your awareness and your journey and the commitment to write this book and to share your development. Now, we're heading towards the end of the program. I just wanted to ask, as a closing thought, what is your hope for folks out there, for your kids, for me, my kids, as you mentioned before, the Sufi or the Muslim or the Christian out there? What vision, the optometrist, what vision do you have going forward?
More than a vision, perhaps more of a hope than a vision, but that we are, in fact, as a society, transforming, moving forward. There are certain segments in society who believe that we are moving forward. And in terms of becoming more universally aware and less divisive and maybe more towards the mystic stance type of thing. And I hope we are moving forward. And my book was my small effort to maybe nudge that a little bit in one direction, to the extent that, no one can really no one can really push these things forward, but just maybe nudge it a little bit.
Yes, thank you so much. And, if life is a wonder, anything that helps reconnect us to the wonder of it is a gift. So as we come to the end of the program, I just want to let listeners know that all your website and contact information and book information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. And Margaret, I just want to thank you so much for being on the program today. It's been a pleasure getting to know you and speaking with you. And before we close today's program, I wanted to offer you a tip for your spiritual tool belt that you wrap around yourself each day. Here, where we live at the Godspeed Institute, the leaves are turning deep red and gold now as we get deeper into the autumn season and deeper into the school season, as well as sports. And this always brings to mind for me football and preparing for Thanksgiving. And as we prepare to bask in the glory of this autumn season, I must tell you that there's more depth and dimension to the musical experience that is the marching band on the gridiron than your flat-screen TV will be able to convey. In fact, I've learned that what the marching band has to offer is of epic, mystical proportions, perennial and profound life lessons. I'll tell you why. I was in high school when my family moved from a big city in New York State to a small town in the Midwest. I had studied the flute for many years, but in my new school, if I wanted to play in the orchestra or jazz band, I had to march. Marching band was not only mandatory at Highland High School, it was competitive with grand exhibitions at regional and state. Reluctantly, with the rolling eyeballs of a transplanted New Yorker, I acquiesced and signed up. At the time, I perceived marching band as a kind of punishment for wanting to play in the orchestra, and that there were two sub-punishments that went along with being first flute. One was playing that blasted, shrill, tiny woodwind from hell I considered the piccolo, and more importantly, having to lead several sections of the band behind me as we formed the design on the field. This was real responsibility for my 16-year-old self, and in a different way from other club activities that I had experienced involving practice and teamwork. Marching band was demanding. There were practices in the hot sun, there were practices in the rain and mud, there were few acceptable excuses for messing up, and as time went on, there were fewer attempts to find those excuses. There were brilliant drummers who discovered ways to be creative within the rigorous structure. And there was, of course, the joy of the music being played seemingly against all odds. We got to state that year. All these years later, I don't recall if we won, but I do recall what I learned that season. One, this is not a drill. Walking out on the field, there is no looking back. There is no second guessing, rehearsing, or restarting. If you lose focus or doubt yourself, you will stumble, and those following you will stumble too. Life lesson. We have people following us in life, at home, at work, on the road. Get on the good foot, stay focused, stay present, trust your instincts, and move forward with confidence. 2, make choices. The pressure was on. I stepped my left foot out onto the beat to walk 8 steps to the 5-yard line and either turn left or right to make my part of the design. There were times I could not do everything needed. I had to make a decision in the moment. Do I play the flute or count steps for the design? Instinctively, I held the flute silently in place at my chin and focused on leading and counting steps. Life lesson? We can't always provide every given component in a situation. It's all right. Determine priorities, make clear choices, and discard ego. Don't attempt to do it all if it will be detrimental to the larger picture of life, events, and relationships. 3, perspective is everything. This is perhaps my favorite aspect of marching band. When you're walking on the field, forming a design, you can't see what you're making. It's simply too big. You're just a pinpoint on a map, like one of those enormous Nazca drawings in Peru. You can't see the design from your perspective on the ground. It can only be perceived from above. Life lesson? Often we will not be able to see the big picture of our lives as we are living it day to day. We create our designs as best we can with others. We may feel our efforts are not fruitful. It takes an element of faith to keep walking forward in trust, even when you feel you're not yet seeing results. Stay strong. Keep the faith that your life is effective, whether you're able to see that big picture or not. 4, impermanence. Finally, like a sand painting in a Buddhist monastery, the design we have worked so diligently to make is complete. We stand still and just breathe, glowing, basking in it. Then after a moment's satisfaction and joy in its creation, the design falls away as we leave the field. Life lesson. It doesn't last long. Enjoy it. We may not be permanent, but we can leave our mark, our essence, and the effects of our efforts and love in this place. Our designs do not last, but the beauty remains. And P.S., I still walk 8 steps to the 5-yard line. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hellenbeck. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And remember to join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here on the Progressive Radio Network each week on Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.